Welcome everybody to the Aris Meyer podcast. How you doing today? I am joined today by a very interesting guy that I know mostly from social media. We've met a couple of times in person, but I feel like I've known him a lifetime. He has a really cool vibe, very interesting guy. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Pierkowski. Did I say that right, Pete?
You got it. Yeah. Pierkowski, you got it right.
How you doing, man?
Great. Oh, doing great. Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Aris. Again, very humbled to be in your podcast. Appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Welcome to the Aris Meyer podcast. You are in the house. So tell the people a little bit about yourself.
Oh, man. Well, what would you like to know? I mean, yeah.
Give me the broad strokes of where you grew up, where you went to school.
Yeah, I had a very, very unique upbringing. Grew up in an extreme religion. I actually dropped out of school in seventh grade. The last grade I officially graduated was sixth. So I have no real formal education past then. I did a few months in seventh grade. Was, you know, asked to leave.
Uh-oh.
But just kind of started doing my own thing from a young age. I ended up sort of skipping middle school. I went to a boarding school in Korea for about half a year. Similar situation, got in a little bit of trouble, quote unquote asked to leave. Just kind of skipped high school. I got my EMT certification when I first, I did some travels in Europe. I went to like 30 countries when I was 18, 19. So when I got back, I was like, okay, what do I do? So I decided I want to be a paramedic. I figured that would be a, you know, really gnarly thing, or a really awesome career choice. So I got my EMT, never actually practiced, but that's essentially the extent of my schooling is sixth grade and then little bits and pieces here and there.
Were you, if I may ask, were you just getting in a lot of fights or you just were just not into learning?
No, man. I've always just kind of done things my own way. I have like pretty, totally have ADHD and I hesitate to even say it because I feel like it's such a common term nowadays. I got ADD, I got ADHD. Even I was diagnosed with it as a kid and I didn't even take it seriously because I'm like every other person has ADD. Recently I've really recognized symptoms. Like I really do have ADHD. So I just couldn't sit in class, man. I would be just like pacing in the back of the room or like, and this is the beautiful thing about some of my teachers. Some of my teachers understood that. And I still to this day have the most gratitude to them. For example, my sixth grade teacher, Beverly Byrne, you might know her, but she understood that I kind of just had special needs as a student. And she gave me like a squeeze toy because she understood I had to constantly be in some sort of motion. So I've had teachers that to this day have been extraordinary teachers because they've been able to sort of cater to the needs of special students. Whereas I had teachers that would shame me for kind of those ADD or ADHD tics. And growing up, I didn't fucking know the difference. I was just like, I need to get up and pace.
Yeah, for sure.
And you know, you can imagine how disruptive that would be in a classroom. So, essentially that was it, man. I was pretty, I always had a pretty good intentions as a kid, never really meant to harm, but I just couldn't sit still. And I just didn't really ever want to listen to what someone was telling me to do. Cause I just never really wanted to. Yeah. So that's kind of where I would get in trouble. Just that kind of shit.
Yeah. What did your, so when you got asked to leave school, what did your parents do? Did they just like homeschool you or they were just like I guess you're coming to work with me or like what happened?
So in seventh grade I had some friends that were homeschooling and I was got in a lot of trouble. I was in a school that had kind of a system. Okay, if you get a certain amount of detentions, you get suspensions, X amount of suspensions, you get, you know, expulsion or extended suspension. And it's kind of at that point where it was just beginning of seventh grade and I was already like two suspensions in. And so I convinced my mom, I was like, you know, let me homeschool with my friends. And they were like, okay, fine. I think simultaneously that the principal had to talk to my mom and was like, you know, kind of like he needs to leave. So I started the homeschool thing, but I just never did it. I really just never, I just never did it. So dude, I had such an exciting teenage years because I was 14 and I was just pretty free. And I started a little lawn mowing business, and that was, you know, I came from very humble beginnings. So that was kind of how I started kind of the business oriented thing. I used to buy things from a dollar store, go door to door, sell my $2. I was like, you know, 13, 14. Back on your question, started out as homeschool, and then I kind of was just pushing the limits of my parents and realized like, they're not going to force me to do this work, and I can copy my friends. They won't even know if I did it or not. And, you know, at 16, I volunteered in after Katrina hit. So by 15, my parents were already like, you know, he's just going to do his own thing. And I'm so grateful for them for just letting me have that freedom, because I was able to explore from a young age and discover so much. But at 16, I was going to move to Colorado because I wanted to be a pro snowboarder. And then Hurricane Katrina happened, and I was like, fuck it, I'm going to go. How can I, you know what I mean, try to be a snowboarder when like this devastation's happening in my country? And I just felt this like calling, I need to go and then help, because I don't have anything better to do. I'm just literally playing Counter-Strike at home. Mm-hmm. Ended up living on a boat at 16. I initially went with a Mooney group, and after a week, I ended up living on a boat on the Mississippi River with a Christian organization called Friendships, because they had ships donated from the military. So there's just all these ex-military boats run by this Christian group. So I was living there for like 2 months. But my point is, I just kind of had a very abnormal childhood. I had, my dad was a priest and my mom was a nun. So their idea of the way the world worked was totally different from anyone else that I knew or any of my other friends' parents. So my parents really didn't care what I did, as long as in their eyes, I was a moral person or a good person. So I feel like, it was just a fascinating childhood.
Wow, that's crazy. It sounds like you were in Katrina sooner than George Bush was. It sounds like you just jumped right in, man. I mean, it speaks to your character as a person to decide to go to Katrina. Like, most people aren't just rolling into a disaster area to do humanitarian work, you know? But it is interesting, because I feel like a lot of people go to school and they follow the K-12, you know, community college, then regular college. And, you know, a lot of people say college is like a place to find yourself, to challenge ideas, to learn things. But it sounds like if you you had really cool parents that were just very open to letting you do those things from a young age, which is super unique. I mean, most people for sure, that's not how that happened. That's crazy, man. Wow. Yeah. So what did you do when you were there? Like, when you were on the boats? Like, what kind of work was it for Katrina?
You know, for Katrina, I got there maybe, I think it might've been in like early September. So it was maybe a couple of weeks after it hit. I initially went to, I think, Bela Bashri, Alabama. I was there for a week. Dude, it was crazy. I mean, I was 16 and I saw like boats and houses, just because the floods were so high. These boats would get drifted and end up in just straight up in a house. And there was like, not dust, but like debris just everywhere, all over all the streets. So but at this point, everything was it was all pretty deserted, and thankfully at that point, I think all the a lot of the really hard labor was done. It's hard to talk about, but the bodies were cleared. I wasn't kind of in that ground zero zone, but I was there kind of in the aftermath cleanup. And mostly what I did was it was cleanups, and it was just food distribution. We had tents where we would cook food, and anyone who was still in New Orleans, and a lot of it was construction crews, we would be feeding them. So it was very, very simple job, but very, very fulfilling. Yeah.
Wow. After you do something like that, did you feel like, okay, now I feel like I can do something for myself, I'm going to go learn to snowboard? Or like, where did that take you, bro?
Oh man. Yeah. It was a really interesting time. So my dad had a stroke while I was in Katrina. So I didn't know it at the time, but when I left for Katrina, it was the last time I was going to see my dad.
Oh, wow.
I came back when I saw him again, he was unconscious and with tubes and all of that. So I think I'm not sure where my life would have gone if that wasn't the case, but kind of coming back to, essentially my dad's death, and there was a lot of other kind of very depressing. That was a very depressing time for me. I was very much I think I had a depression. Yeah, it was a deep, deep, deep depression stage at that point. So I kind of, I didn't really do too much when I got back. I got back in November, kind of dealt with my dad's death. And then 7 months later, did SDF for 6 months. So I did some kind of mission work traveling the West Coast.
Yeah.
I left after 6 months. I realized I came home for Christmas break and was like, and then I went back after. And then right when I got back, I was like, dude, what am I doing here? I was like, all my problems are at home. Like, this is just this bubble I'm living in. And
yeah,
it kind of just hit me really hard. And I was like, fuck it. Like, well, I was 18. I was like, what do I want to do? I was like, when I got back, I became a car salesman, and I was working in a cubicle for like 2 months. And I was like, what? It's like, I do not want to do this. And I was like, what do I want to do? And that's when just fucking one-way ticket to Europe. I just bought it for November. And I think that's what really sort of kickstarted the rest of my life, was just seeing the world. And, you just get a whole new perspective of life, you know?
Yeah. I remember I when I went to STF, which is the Unification Church's like missionary thing after high school. I remember like going there, and I left also after 5 or 6 months, because I felt like all we did there was fundraise and make money. And I was like, this is the least religious and least connected to spirituality, least connected to God that I've ever been in my entire life. Cause I literally just feel like slave labor, you know, like sleeping in dugouts and carports and like eating fucking Wendy's every night. So I know, you know, I think every situation is different for everybody. What you pull out of it is different for everybody. But I think for certain people, that kind of program was just like what I've already suffered in my life. What am I doing this for? Like, this is not helping me in any way. But what was it about Europe that made you want to go there, bro? Like, why of all places did you want to go to Europe?
Oh man. Well, I wanted to see the world. I'm not really sure exactly what it was, which brought me to Europe. I just remember I've only been to Asia at that point. And, I couldn't really tell you what brought me there, but I just remember I had a 6-week trip plan initially. I had like a Eurorail thing, and I was just going to kind of wing my whole trip. And it was like my third or fourth day there. I was like skateboarding through Scotland, and I had just snuck into this castle that was like on the lake with the Loch Ness. And it was this feeling of, I was literally like skating like miles through the Highlands to get to some bus station to try to eventually get to France. And I was just like this feeling of freedom that I had never really known in my life at that point yet. And it became the most just like addicting. I was like, I just want to live in this, just fucking free, where I'm just, you know what I mean? Like, so what brought me out to Europe, I'm not sure, but within a few days, that experience, that was what brought me out there. It was, whether you want to call it your higher self, your subconscious, whatever it is that guides our lives, my life, I needed that experience, because that's what awoke me. And so something guided me out there, and who knows what it was, but I like to think my higher self did. Yeah.
That's cool, man. Yes. Skateboarding in Scotland. That's crazy. Is that the first, the first country that you chose to go to was Scotland?
I landed in London, went to Scotland. And then from there I did everything, France, Spain, pretty much went 6 weeks. I ended up in Norway. So I was supposed to fly home from London, and, I ended up like homeless in the Arctic in Sweden. I was like, it's a whole nother crazy story of itself. But I ended up, when I was supposed to be flying back to Norway, or flying back to America from London, I was just in Norway. And I was like, well, fuck it, I'm not going home. So I had a bunch of Italian friends that I met when I was in Czech Republic on New Year's. I was like, well, fuck it, I'm going to go to Italy and just, see what I can do. So I ended up in Rome, man, and I just had this like dead broke. I was like homeless, sleeping on the streets, just like. But I had this just calling to be in Rome. It was the most fascinating city to me because you're in like a modern city, but then there's just the fucking Colosseum and these just like ancient, you know what I mean? You know, just ancient buildings, just ancient shit, just all around. It was just so mixed. So I just felt this calling. I wanted to be there, and I got a job at a youth hostel, just sort of, you know, checking people in. Yeah. And dude, it was the best fucking time because we just partied. All like my only job was I had to check in guests, and I'm in a youth hostel. So every day I'm meeting people from all around the world. And the vibe is just like there's just a vibe with hostels. It's just like you're the vibe in hostels is just like you're everyone's friend unless they have a reason to not be their friend, because we're all traveling, we're all backpackers, we don't have any of our comforts from home. You know, we're all just fucking on the road. So there's just this culture among backpackers that's like, you know what I mean? Like, we're friends unless you prove that you're not. So every day was just such a fucking party, man. And I don't want to get too off topic, man, but when I was in Rome, we were fucking wasted one night, and we were like, let's break in the Colosseum.
Shut the fuck up, dude.
Yeah, man. So we found a way in. We were like circling the place. We found a way in. And then, dude, I must have gone back like 13 or 15 times. I started doing tours because I'd work in the hostels, and the hostels were connected. Mm-hmm. So every day there'd be these backpackers from all around the world that would come in, and I would be like, yo, do you guys want to do something fucking dope? And they'd be like, yeah. And we would just party and then break the Colosseum. And if you go in the daytime, there's like a very specific area you're allowed to tour. Mm-hmm. But we learned the ins and outs, like a blueprint of the Colosseum. And there were like straight up crumbling stairwells from like that, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, however long ago. And we would be, dude, we used to smoke up down there. We'd be like playing tag. And I remember just like fucking being blazed one time, just like sitting and like realizing I'm in this, probably where they used to keep the lions. It was just like underneath the Colosseum in this like cave, so to speak. And just like, but bro, there's a weight when you're in there. There's a heaviness because of the gnarly shit that took place there. And I think especially when you're smoking, you become a little more in tune to it. So I don't mean any disrespect by partying in the Colosseum. You know, one, it's a gnarly place to be. It's a fucking, you know, really fun place to party. And I used to love bringing backpackers to give them this experience. But at the same time, it's humbling because you know how much suffering and how much horror actually took place in there. So at the same time, you know, I mean no disrespect by kind of our shenanigans in there. But yeah, dude, I was doing like nighttime Colosseum tours.
that's so and, wild. It's crazy to travel to places. I mean, America has a lot of history, right? But the majority of the history before the Europeans got here is native history. And the places that are powerful in native history are all like, you know, mountains and forests and natural places. So you could go to like, you know, the Black Hills and places like that. And there's like a juju in the air there. But for Americans, our history is so current that there's not really too many places where you feel that weight. And I remember going to Israel for the first time, and almost immediately you feel the centuries of what you're describing, like just lives, you know, here and gone, famous places from people that we could only imagine about, you know, from the Bible or from whatever, going to places that, you know, that might as well be fucking Narnia or from Lord of the Rings or something, because we've only read about them in these stories. And I think it helps us embrace our own humanness and our own mortality almost, you know, like, It adds a beauty to the fact that we're only here for so many years, because everybody before us was only here for so many years. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you felt like that, but that's how I felt, like, you know, going to Bethlehem where Jesus was born or places like that. And I got to have one little experience like yours, where I was hanging out with these Palestinians, and they took me to this place, and they were kind of like digging and creating a space, and they were like, this is a very famous place, but people don't come here. And I was like, oh, what is it? And they were like, oh, this is where, Jesus brought Lazarus back from the dead. They said, this is the place where Lazarus Lazarus was killed and brought back. And I felt like so special to be able to go to that place. And just because I had befriended them, they brought me there. But yeah, traveling is special, man. I think especially for Americans, it's something that changes our perspective, man. Because everything is so new and easy here.
Absolutely. Yeah. That sounds incredible, the way that experience. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you're traveling around Europe. And then you come home. What did you do when you came home?
When I came home, I got a job as a waiter and decided to get my EMT certification. So that's when I was 19 and I got my EMT certification. Yeah.
Certified. What made you not want to be an EMT?
I just never panned out. I mean, I got my certification. I was going to go to school to be a paramedic, but I got really into poker. At that point, I had turned 20 and I was a huge gambler at heart. And I found like a ring of underground poker, because I couldn't go to Atlantic City yet, on the East Coast, 2 hours away. So at 20, I found there was like an underground ring of poker games throughout the DMV. So it'd be like Tuesdays, I'd be going to Upper Marlboro, Wednesdays, DC, Thursdays, Silver Spring. And dude, it was fucking crazy, because you're playing these games that are taking a rake. And I remember playing this game in Silver Spring, and we would get a phone call, or the dude who runs the game would get a phone call, be like, yo, Marlboro just got robbed. Like, it was a common thing where you hear people run in there with shotties. So a lot of the games ended up breaking. However, dude, it's crazy. It was like an office complex, and there's this one game, and it's literally called The Office, and it's still, I hesitant to say publicly, it's still around today.
Allegedly, it's still around today.
Allegedly, yeah. And Doug, it's like you roll up, and it's like a two-door lock system. So you get viewed by a camera, you go in. There's like two armed guards on the, on the outside all times. Like, it's a heavily protected game. But now we got legal casinos. I don't really fuck with it now. But yeah, when I was 20, man, I was working. Actually, I got a job as a security guard, and I was doing that, and I was just playing poker. So as soon as I turned 21, I moved to Atlantic City. I lived in Atlantic City for a few months and was kind of pursuing pro poker. Yeah,
man, you've really just like, you just follow your intuition, huh? That's like a
absolutely,
so many people don't have the heart. I mean, including myself, don't have the heart to do something like that. Just follow your intuition.
You have to, man. That's what leads you to all these. I mean, I wouldn't say you have to, but I feel like our intuition's there for a reason. It's like our guide, and we have to trust it, because it's our, we have to trust that voice. It's going to guide us to good things. And at least that's my belief, is to just, to feel like, for me, at least, even a lot of my business decisions, I'm a very much an intuitive. I make a lot of decisions that don't make sense logically. They're just purely intuitive. But I think through a long period of time, I've kind of built that relationship with my intuition. And I recommend it to everyone. Our intuition is one of the most unique things about us. And it's especially catered to us. And it's a really beautiful thing when we can kind of have that relationship with that intuitive self.
Speaking of relationship with self, I know that you're a big proponent of pushing your body. You're a disciple of Mr. Wim Hof, who I learned about on Joe Rogan. And to the people listening, can you tell them a little bit about Mr. Hof and what that practice is?
Man, Wim is absolutely, I would say, besides my mother and possibly my wife, my greatest teacher in life. He's one of the most humble beings I've ever met. I have, the utmost respect for Wim. And in 2016, I lived with him in a cabin for about a week. And the organization was pulling in serious money, like I think 80, 90K per week. Wim slept on a bunk bed with all the participants. And dude, he would just be strumming the guitar, same board shorts every day. But I've never met someone in my life that is so free. Wim's so free, and it's such a it's so refreshing to be in his presence. So he's a really big inspiration. But beyond that, he's I wouldn't say he's pioneered, you know, his breathwork techniques, but I would say he's really brought in modern science to these techniques, which have been around for centuries, if not millennials. I mean, this is the shit that Shaolin monks are doing. This is the shit that is from ancient Tibet. He's, you know, he's been doing a lot of university studies showing the science behind meditation, but more so the science behind breathwork and the power we have to literally rewire our brains, rewire our physiology, and literally alter our physiology through breathwork. And it's really incredible shit, man. And I think Wim, he's a very much an extremist, and you get that energy when you're around him. And, you know, yeah, you know, he's just an incredible human being.
So when I read about him, and when I've, you know, seen him on podcasts, the main thing that he's known for is kind of being in like sub-zero climate, super cold, snowy Arctic weather, and, you know, dressed like he's on the Waikiki beach. I mean, and just like tiny shorts and nothing else. And breath work, like you said. So he'll take people and they'll do like polar bear plunges or hikes or stuff like that out in the cold, barely wearing anything. Yeah. Can you explain what that practice brought out in you and what it means to you? I mean, doing those kind of extreme temperature things like.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you, you know, I did it twice. I did it in 2016. I did it recently. It's changed a lot recently. There's so many people kind of on the Wim Hof train now that it's a lot less intimate than it used to be. It was still an absolute beautiful spiritual experience, but I always cherish my first experience with him because it was very intimate. We were just in the cabin, kind of like I was saying. But, you know, I'll paint the picture for you. I'm pretty much naked. I got my Adidas short shorts on, like 5-inch seams, and I got some Nike sneakers. Mm-hmm. It's negative 22 degrees Fahrenheit.
Good Lord.
We're hiking. We're hiking Snezhka, which is in between Poland and Czech Republic. And we had trained for it through a week through breath work. So basically putting your body into an alkaline state through I'm hesitant to talk a lot about the science behind it because I don't think I'm the best person to talk about it. But basically through a week of doing the breath techniques, putting ourselves in alkaline state, bringing a lot of oxygen to our cells, you're kind of able to withstand this sort of cold. And I'll never forget the feeling because it was so life-changing of when we were ascending Mount Snezhka and it's negative 22 degrees I don't think I've ever been so close to death before, you know, where literally I know logically I'm supposed to die in these temperatures by the way I'm dressed. And we had been hiking for like 3 hours. Wow. We took a pit stop in a cabin, but at the bottom it was snowing. So I know it was at least 32 degrees or less at the bottom, right? It's at least freezing. And I know that day at the time we were up there, the summit was negative 22 degrees Fahrenheit. So logically speaking, you should die. And I remember being like, we were hiking maybe like 2 hours in and, you know, we're doing this kind of breath technique and your extremities are frozen, but your core body is warm. And I remember being like, I wonder how cold it is. It doesn't feel that bad. And then you see people hiking down and they're like fucking Eskimos. Mm. And that's when you feel cold. And do you know what it is? It's the fucking doubt that goes into your mind. This is how powerful our minds are, is that when you believe you're not cold and you believe you can withstand this shit, you actually can. But as soon as I saw all these fucking Eskimos coming down the mountain, that's when I started to literally start shivering because doubt goes in your mind. And this is how powerful our brains are. And this is literally how we can tap into just the infinite of all the shit we can accomplish by the power of our minds. But anyway, but when we're actually summiting it, I think it was absolutely one of the best experiences of my entire life because you're so close to death, but you just go beyond it. You have this fear, and the only way to summit this where you know it's negative 22 and you know you got to climb it naked, you have to go beyond that fear. And I think when I was able to do that, it's just the most addicting feeling ever, because to be without fear is just complete pure freedom. So to feel freedom and it's just pure essence like that, I remember when I was flying home after that trip, I was like, this is all I want to do is climb mountains naked, to constantly push myself to overcome fear and overcome what is believed to be impossible, because fuck it. If I, you know what I mean? Like, our brain, our mind is so powerful, and the way we can alter our own physiology is powerful.
It's crazy how many things that people, like, you read books and you watch movies and you talk to people and they talk about things like this and they ascribe this woo woo factor, right? Like, no, this is just spiritual mumbo jumbo. This is nonsense. You know, you got to live your normal life, 9 to 5, get the job, get the house, have the kids. But then somebody like you, who's from America, you know, who's done that stuff, you go to this place and you were able to get pretty much butt ass naked and do something that anyone thinks, you know, it would kill me. I feel like it would kill me, but I mean, it's almost like pulling back the curtain of life a little bit, isn't it? Like, being able to experience it yourself, almost, it brings you to that, to the next level of, oh yeah, this is real life. This is possible. It's not woo woo.
I think absolutely. I mean, I think when we push ourselves to such extremes, it's like, well, hey, if I can do this, what else can I do? You know what I mean? Like, shit is impossible because we believe it's impossible. I mean, and a great example of this is the first person to break a mile. I believe it's in under 4 minutes. I forgot the what the metric is, and it was some point in the 20th century, but it was deemed scientifically impossible. And again, I hesitate to quote me on 4 minutes. I believe it was 4 minutes, but you know, don't quote me on that exactly. But I believe it was deemed scientifically possible to break a mile within 4 minutes. It was never done before. And then a runner does it by like a millisecond. He breaks it. And you know what happens 2 weeks later? Another runner breaks it. And since then, like, we've had endless runners break this. But the point is, it was only impossible because we were limiting ourselves because we believed it was impossible. As soon as one person broke it, someone else did. Why didn't that other person break it first? Does that make sense? Once someone breaks it, it creates a whole new ceiling. You know what I mean? It's just life is just a mindset thing. It's all in our minds, and we're capable of, it's just crazy to me how much I think humanity holds ourselves back by these own limitations and ceilings that we have, that we don't even, these concepts, we don't even realize we create them for ourselves, but we live within these concepts. And I think school in many ways is a great thing. I think our surgeons, our lawyers, you know, these people that are pursuing these paths, it's a beautiful thing. But I also think school gives us these concepts that we don't necessarily need. I mean, traditional schooling, traditional ways of life, like, since when? Like, someone, like, this is all man-made shit. And that's one of the reasons I'm so grateful I didn't go to school, because I didn't have, and again, I mean, no offense to anyone that did, but I just think, like, I didn't have any pre-notions put in my brain or pre-concepts on the way shit is supposed to be done. So I entered life doing shit the way I wanted to do it, not based off how I heard it's done, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
I think it's, yeah, in some ways school's amazing, and I think in other ways it can be very limiting. Yeah.
It's, sometimes I think about, I'm super into philosophy and music and religion, spirituality. And, you know, I read so many different teachers. I listen to so many different kinds of music and interviews with people. And lately I've been really into Bob Marley. The last couple years I've been
he's the man,
kind of like jumping from person to person, and it's been him recently. And what's interesting about people like him is they're saying what you're saying. You know, you watch all these interviews with him, and it's these white or German, Australian, American people interviewing him, and they just want to talk shit about, oh, Rastafari is so terrible. Oh, you guys, all you do is smoke marijuana and sell marijuana. But he returns those comments with like this almost profound simplicity about, you know, all the stuff people know about Marley, which is love, which is, you know, it doesn't matter what you have, it matters how you live. These very like simple, profound truths. And to me, it almost seems like we live in two different realities. And one is a very structured, you know, almost like what you were saying with school, they teach you a very specific way to live. This ladder, you can take this ladder, and if you start at the bottom rung, you can walk all the way up if you do these things. And then there's people like our spiritual teachers that are like, hey, there's this up and down ladder, but did you know you can also go left and right? And I think that that's what's really cool about philosophy, and that's what's really cool about, you know, you getting to meet Wim Hof and experience these kind of things where, like, you know, I'm sure walking up that mountain changed your entire life. Like, every doubt that you ever had, when you're halfway up that thing butt ass naked, you're just like, I could ask out any girl I want, I could go to any place. Like, it's empowering, right? So yeah, I don't know if that makes sense, but
absolutely, man, we can do absolutely anything we want, and the only thing that's holding ourselves back is ourselves. And I'm a, you know, very firm believer of that. Yeah, the world's in our hands. The thing is, we're borrowing everything we have, and you know, that's, I think, you know, I'm a big believer in not attaching to things and not letting your ego take over. And I think everything we have is a resource and it's a tool, and we're meant to be on a journey, and we're all on a journey. But I think it's a delusion to say that the shit we get is ours, if that makes sense. It's all just experiences, and it's things I like to think we're borrowing or we're using as resources. But
I mean, if it was ours, we'd take it with us when we died, right?
Exactly.
If it was ours.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, absolutely.
So, yeah. So you know, you went to Europe, you've had these experiences. After poker, one of the things I know about you is that you kind of started your own business. And I remember for years now seeing on social media that you were selling calendars, right?
Yeah.
So your business is called Bright Day Calendars. And, you know, I don't know you that well, but I've known throughout the years that you have a very entrepreneurial spirit, because, you know, you're very free on social media, sharing about your interactions with your staff, with your team. And even during the pandemic, some of the things you were talking about that these big companies are fighting about, should we do this? Should we do that? Should we give people time off? Should we, you know, it seems to me that it bled, your beliefs bled very clearly into how you run your business. Do you feel like that's true?
Yeah, absolutely. You mean as far as I definitely don't run my business traditionally.
You treat your employees, how you interact with, you know, people that want your product.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to staff, this is kind of where I've always considered life as my teacher, other than school. I just remember getting to this, you know, before my business was really kind of self-sufficient where I could live off that, I was working various jobs, and I remember being so fucking depressed working all these jobs. I felt like the life was sucked out of me. So as soon as my company was kind of at the ability where we were able to where we were making a little bit extra, the first thing I wanted was, like, I don't want to do what was, like, I don't want to repeat this. Like, I want to be fucking different. So I am really proud of the benefits we offer. I mean, we're a small business. I think, you know, 15 staff right now. So I consider it a small business. We offer health insurance, dental, 401k with 100% company match of 5%. We do, you know, weekly or paid vacations. We do paid protest days. We've just introduced half day Fridays.
Did you say paid protest days?
Yeah.
Like, so if someone wants to go to a protest.
Yeah. So if there's anything that you believe in, you have 2 days a year completely paid. It's not a sick day. It's not a leave day. It's not a vacation day. If there is something that you believe in, you know, this is how we see change. Mm. And the fact is, it's companies that, you know, how many people are, what's the word? Like, you're working to live. So, like, or living to work. So you can't, you might believe in something, but you can't lose a day of work. Mm-hmm. So you can't be there. Your voice can't be heard. And then this shit just hit me in fucking June. I was like, yo, this is fucked up, because it's like people are living on a paycheck to paycheck, and they can't, you know, they don't have that ability for their voice to be heard. And I was like, I don't want to be a part of that shit. So that's when we introduced our paid protest days. And it's just, yo, if there's some shit that you believe in, you have the right for your voice to be heard, and you're not going to be, you know what I mean? It's initially when we did it, it was a half day. Then we said, fuck it. You get two days a year, whenever you want. If there's something you believe in, you have the right for your voice to be heard. So we've incorporated that. We do monthly stipulants. So you have like everyone has a certain amount of month that they can use Starbucks or wherever they want. Half day Fridays, we do paid meditations, paid breath work, everything, man. I mean, I think if you're running a company, you have an ethical responsibility to take care of everyone who works for you. I really see it as a, I don't see quote unquote employees, I see them as my team. And, I just think, I think the way the corporate system has been over the last few decades is really fucked up and backwards. And I just think, we're all fucking humans, man. And whenever, you know, we haven't in a year because of COVID, but when we used to meet before we would have our company meetings, we would all meditate for 4 minutes. And the reason behind it is our positions, your status, whatever you are in the company doesn't fucking matter because we're all humans, including myself. I don't want to be the fucking boss, man. It's just like, I just happened to start this company and people happen to work for me, but that's not how I really want to be seen. That's not my relationship I want. I just want to be a fucking human because that's what I am. And I want to be, you know what I mean? So before we even meet, we take a few minutes to just meditate because the purpose behind it is we're all just fucking humans. And let's all just take off our statuses and let our fucking ego go a little bit. And let's just all be human together for a couple minutes, you know, and then let's talk business. So that's the purpose behind it, man. And I think just being so fucking depressed in the jobs I've worked, when I was in the position to hire a staff, the only thing I knew was I don't want to do that. I don't wish what I experienced on anyone at all, especially people that work for me. I feel great loyalty to anyone that works for me, man. Money is infinite. Time is finite. Mm-hmm. Time is the most valuable thing that we have. And many people don't realize that, dude, there are fucking 10 million ways to make money. Money is infinite. It's just, it's everywhere, man. There's so many different ways. Time is finite. And anyone who works for me, I have the utmost gratitude because they're giving me their time. There's nothing, you know, I'm like humbled by that. I'm like, what can I do in return to thank you for the time that you're giving me? Cause you're not going to get that back. So at the very least, I want to be able to create a work environment that's also serving to my staff and serving to my team. I want them to come in and whenever they leave, whether working at Bright Day Company is a stepping stone for them or whether it's a career choice, I want them to leave with more than they came with. Because I know all the jobs I worked, I felt like I was sucked dry. So that's why we do all these benefits. And that's why I do this shit. And, you know, we're growing pretty fast right now, but up until this point, we've had this kind of culture. It's been a very lax culture and very much an honor system. You know, like we do a lot of work, man. You know, we're definitely busy seasonally. But anyway, yeah, man. So I have a lot of philosophy when it comes to the way I have a lot of issues with the way corporations are run. I have a lot of issues with the fucking greed that's controlling our planet right now. And, my mindset is, there's a lot of power, man. There's a lot of power behind big money. Like money controls this world. I personally believe that money controls our government. Money is controlling everything behind the scenes. And one of the biggest inspirations for my Bright Day was like, I think one of the ways to defeat that is to beat it at its own game. You know what I mean? I want to create a company that's the opposite of that. And I'd love to create we're in the process and we've been working to create a business model, which is the general mindset behind capitalism is just like, I feel like it's taking and it's exhausting. When I hang out with people who have businesses, it's just like, how can I maximize what I'm making? And it's a very exhausting conversation to have. And what I'm trying to think is, how can we create, let's take a different look at capitalism. Like, how can we create a business model which both profits the business and gives back to the world at the same time? And I don't think it's, you know, that hard to incorporate. I mean, where initially you start incorporating that is in our rescue line. And maybe we can touch on that later, but it's just a very specific line in our calendar company where, but this is what I'm thinking. And it's just like, and I think a lot more companies are starting to think this way. And it's just like, yo, if we can just not think completely about ourselves, if we can just also think about what we're affecting, I think you know, there's so many companies destroying the world right now. You know what I mean? Like we have the, I believe CEOs have an ethical responsibility to protect this planet. We have an ethical responsibility to find ways that that are environmentally safe and environmentally stable. You know, it's just, it's a crazy time, man. And yeah, anyway.
I'm so fucking about that. I mean, you know, I've worked for so many different companies and, you know, I put everything into whatever I do. And I've always been a person that's about compassion and mutual respect. So the people that I work with, you know, become like family. We're in the trenches. We're in this together. And it's just it's a never ending cycle of being disappointed by the companies that I work for, because, you know, I do my best to put my best foot forward, work as hard as I can. And, you know, there's these things in America that, oh, he never takes sick days. He's never late. He's so, you know, loyal. He, you know, whatever, whatever. But at the same time, as soon as, you know, the hours ain't there or the money ain't right or whatever, they drop you like a bad habit. They'll just kick somebody to the curb. And, you know, it's never been more obvious. I mean, it's always been obvious if you're looking, but when you're looking at it these days during the pandemic and seeing the billionaires become trillionaires and the regular workers who are literally putting their life on the line become, you know, hundredaires, if even hundredaires, it's just too crazy. And we're supposed to be the greatest country on earth. We're supposed to be, you know, God chose this place. This is a Christian nation. Whoop de whoop de whoop de whoop. But we can't even treat people right. The people that are, like you said, giving their time, giving their life to whatever it is that we're doing, buying in, and you know, whether that's at McDonald's, whether it's on the field picking fruit, or you know, in Amazon warehouse, wherever it is, you know, people are putting themselves on the line. So I think it's to hear you say that. And I mean, you're not a huge business. You don't have Amazon type money, but you're putting other human beings where you are at. And I don't know. I mean, maybe, you know, are there other famous company founders who did those kind of things? I mean, did Steve Jobs do that, you know, and Wozniak and Bezos, you know, and any of those people?
You know, I'm not really sure. I don't really look so much at what other people are doing. I do believe that there's a new wave of consciousness coming, especially with businesses. I think we're really, really going to start seeing in the next 10, 20 years a different wave of business leadership, a wave of conscious business, business that isn't hurting the environment and hurting people, but is actually finding alternative ways to do business and give back and do business and help the environment. I think this is the future. But you know, as far as what other people are doing, you know, I couldn't really say.
What so your business Bright Day Calendars is, you sell calendars. How did that start? How did you get into the calendar game? Like where did that inspiration come from?
Yeah, you know, man, you know, it's hard to even exactly pinpoint it. It's almost strange, because when I look at it in hindsight, it almost feels like it was pre-written or meant to be. Because I mean, when I first started selling calendars, people thought I was crazy, but it always made sense to me. And that's because I was 14, 15. I used to buy calendars in the kiosks, or I just fucking wanted my snowboard calendar. And
kiosk, like one of those.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they set it up seasonally with the four fake walls and all the.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's ironic because we're a publisher now, so we actually sell to them. So I love that. Go there. I see.
Let's go.
So it's crazy the way. But anyway. So I was so depressed, man. I was working security. I was playing underground poker, and someone gave me a business card for a bookstore. And I fly out to San Diego. I was working minimum wage, $8 an hour. And I was talking to the owner, and he told me the way he started the business was selling books in a flea market. So my mindset was, how can I, what can I sell in a flea market? And the very last day I was there, I saw a pickup truck full of calendars roll in. And again, I feel like it was meant to be. And I was like, yo, Andy, where'd you get those calendars? And he just gave me a number. And I had my mom's credit card, and I just fucking maxed it out buying calendars. And I was selling it in a flea market. and absolutely failed. Terrible business model. So, but you know, I had like, at the time, I think I bought maybe like three grand worth of calendars, and I was like, what do I do with these? So I put them on eBay, and then overnight I started to sell them. So I went back, I maxed that credit card out, 18 grand. I maxed it out, just fucking buying all these calendars. And it's just grown from there, man. I mean, it's just every year, I don't believe ever in comparing yourself with others. And I do believe in comparing yourself with yourself. So every year it's that mindset of, this is what we're doing. What can we do differently? What can we do better? And it's just constantly asking yourself every year. And, you know, and this is my advice for anyone starting a business right now, any business owners. You know, right now, Bright Day, we're a $10 million company, right? We are, our foundation is selling calendars in a flea market. And my advice to business owners is, I feel like when I talk to people that want to start their own business, when I talk to people that are entrepreneurs, want to do shit, there's this misconceived concept that they have to have it all figured out before. Like, they need a business plan, they need a model, they need funding. No, fuck that. You just need to get started, and you need to pay attention to what's working and what's not working, and you need to let go of what's not working and go with what is working. Because I didn't get to where I was today through any fucking plan at all. All I knew was like, yo, I saw a potential of an opportunity. I took it. That didn't work, but it forced me into a situation which did work. And then from there, that's where the growth happened, was once I found something that could sort of support itself. This whole thing was founded on just selling calendars on eBay. And then we started selling calendars on Amazon. And then I thought, well, you know, we started reaching out to other publishers. We started working other different deals. And then we started selling a lot of calendars. And I was like, well, fuck it. Why not make our own? And then it's like, why stop at calendars? Why not make planners? Why not make, you know what I mean? Like, there's a whole world of other shit out there. And also, why just sell in America? Why not sell in Europe? Why not sell in Japan? You know, right now we're in massive expansions where we're growing a product line. We're growing our international marketplaces, and we're on a wholesale offensive to get in brick and mortar in the country. My point is, we only have ceilings on our ventures if we set them. If we limit ourselves, you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? Like, if we keep an open mind at all times, there is never a limit. And I'm not to say that we should always just go after everything, but you know, we set our own ceilings, man, and we have the decision to set ceilings or not. And personally, I have no attachment to what tomorrow brings. I would like to say I don't even care. I'm just here for the journey, and I'm just here for the experience. And, you know, it's a beautiful journey, and it could end at any time. You know what I mean? What's the point in attaching to it? What's the point in attaching something that, you know, you're going to lose? So for me, it's just all about the journey and all about enjoying yourself and doing it ethically. That's the most important thing, man. And I want to put this out there if anyone hears this. So when we talk about being environmentally conscious, right? So, it's very, very important to me to be environmentally conscious. I do not want to profit off of destroying the earth. However, I'm stuck with the dilemma of calendars are wrapped with cellophane. It's a plastic wrap, and it makes them very difficult to recycle. And I'm searching for a way, either a plant-based cellophane wrap, a biodegradable wrap, or an alternative to a cellophane wrap. And I'll happily just want to offer $5K if anyone's listening to this and they have an idea that we end up bringing to market that works, and we can bring to market and find an alternative to cellophane wrap, happily pay $5K to anyone that's hearing this that has an idea, reaches out. But the issue is a cellophane wrap, and I you know, our calendars are FSC certified, so it's a sustainable paper source, but I'm still stuck with this fucking cellophane, and I don't sleep good at night because of it, because I know the shit's not recyclable, and I know I'm creating a lot of plastic, and I don't want to profit off that shit. So I'm searching right now to try to find some sort of plant-based, or, you know what I mean, biodegradable cellophane wrap. If anyone's listening, you know, happily pay, you know, whatever, a finder's fee for anyone that can kind of help out with that issue.
That's what's up, man. And I mean, that's fucking cool, bro, man.
I'll tell you when it hit me, man. I was tripping on shrooms like 2 years ago. Yeah, man, I was listening to some jazz music, and I'm looking at all these trees and they're all dancing. Mm-hmm. And all these, I'm listening to this jazz music and all these trees are dancing. And that's when it hit me, these beautiful, majestic beings that we live with that literally take our poisonous air and give us oxygen. We rip their fucking leaves off and we burn them for fire. And we like do all kinds of fucked up shit. But these are literally the reason we are living, breathing, alive beings. Mm. And I was on shrooms, man, and these trees were just dancing. And I had this just moment where I was like, wait a second, my whole business is off of trees. And I had this gratitude. And I'm like, I need to protect, like, we need to be protectors of trees. They are also living beings. And I think we really take them for granted. So, you know, I'm really, really, truly searching for ways to be environmentally conscious. And I'm really open-minded to try to find that. But I don't know shit about this, man. I don't know what makes something biodegradable. So, yeah. You know, hopefully someone's listening that knows the answer. And I, you know, reach out to me, Peter, at brighttankcalendars.com.
Yeah, man. If you're listening, reach out. That's what's up. Yeah. See, and that's little changes like that are what changes the future, bro. Is just giving a fuck even a little bit. And also big ups to psychedelics, man. I've had life-changing experiences that would have never happened if I didn't take psychedelics, you know? Especially mushrooms. I had an experience where I was on mushrooms. I've had depression my whole life and I've had like suicidal thoughts my whole life. And I remember doing mushrooms in Joshua Tree. And this is so off topic, but doing mushrooms in Joshua Tree and laying in this bed and kind of like the pictures on the walls are moving. And I'm just thinking and thinking. And my brain was just like, okay, Aris, it's time to die. You want to die? We're going to do it nice and easy, nice and slow. You've always said you wanted to go. It's time to go. Let's go. Unless you don't want to go. And I had this moment where like nature called my bluff. And since then I've never thought about it, but anyone that shits on psychedelics, man, they're, if you're doing them with the right intention, you're going to see the world in a different way. And I think it grounds you, like you said, it reconnects you. So what a spirit, what a vision. Cool. That's really fucking cool.
I'm really, it's really heavy. I'm really glad to hear you don't feel that way anymore. That's really heavy. I'm really sorry, you know, for that pain and what you felt. It's really heavy. But
sorry to drop that on you. It's just when people talk about psychedelics, I'm a big proponent. Like I really feel like it's, you know, especially in the modern world we live in where everything is just anxiety, stress, depression, sadness. There's like little tools that the earth has given us to help reconnect us and remind us who we are, how we're part of the world, how we're part of, you know, everything, how everything's interconnected. So you bringing it up, I always want to echo whenever anyone talks about, especially, you know, mushrooms or natural herbs, we can say. I'm a big proponent.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, absolutely. And I think mushrooms is one of the most well-researched drugs. That's literally scientifically backed to help depression and anxiety and help rewire our brains. And, I don't think it's a coincidence that it's illegal. What I mean? Because it initiates free thinking and what's worse than that from a government's perspective. So, I think it's great that we're kind of going through a little bit of awakening right now and it's starting to become a little more prevalent. But yeah, man, I've never felt more connected to my true self than when I was tripping balls on mushrooms. Yeah. And
it's true. Just laying on the ground, feeling grass, feeling sun, feeling air, like it's next level, man.
Oh yeah. We've all fucking evolved from water and we're all fucking stardust. Mm-hmm. It was literally you and I are the same. We all came from the exact same place. And it's such a delusion to say we haven't. But we've all evolved from the same place. And I think mushrooms brings us back to that connection. But you know, it's fascinating on shrooms when you notice how much around you is breathing. I think you're tripping, but I mean, I know the trees are breathing. I know everything around me is breathing. Everything is alive. And we all truly are connected. On Thursdays, every Thursday at 11:30, I host a breath work and a breath work session with a certified Wim Hof instructor. If you want to join, man, I'd love to awesome to have you, man. I was through a really, really, really dark period last year. deep, really, really dark part of my life. And breath, I had never used breath work. I was only familiar with it with my Wim Hof experience, but I hadn't done it since. And breath work's what something, it really rewired my shit, man. And it really brought me out of a very dark period. Wow. And ever since then, I've had kind of that ritual of breath work. But Dan Day-Lewis, he's the one who does breath work on the Instagram page, Bright Day Company. He's the one who kind of got me on that morning routine and really kind of pulled me out of the mud there. And it's an absolutely powerful, powerful shit, man, that can really rewire our brains and connect us to the kind of the deepest part of ourselves. So absolutely, man, if you have any interest in having a breathwork session from a Wim Hof instructor, I'll send you the Zoom link. We do it every Thursday at 11:30. So it's my company. It's an optional company thing, but I started to invite other family and friends. So dude, if you want to try it, man, it really is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Yeah. I'd love to check in. Definitely, man. You know, I'm trying to find any way that I can to get through this life and find the beauty in it. And I feel like I'm definitely not alone. You know, that's one thing I've always connected with people my whole life, as far as like people going through it, whether it's depression or, you know, having alcoholism, overeating, whatever it is, I've always been able to connect with people that have sadness. And I don't, you know, the thing about feeling that way is you don't want other people to feel that way because you know how bad it is. So I'm on a never ending quest to find things that'll help me to help other people as well, you know? So I'm definitely in for the breath work, and I appreciate that offer.
Yeah, man.
So the next thing I want to know about, so we talked about the calendars, we talked about the poker, the philosophy. Tell me about Time Capsule Collectibles, bro. I recently found out, doing a little deep dive on your social media, you're a collector. Tell me about that.
Yeah, man, dude. So I'm fascinated with time. And I think that's what got me into it, is just I have a fascination with time. But yeah, dude, I started collecting a couple years ago, and I think COVID kind of spiked I got pretty, pretty crazy with it, but I have a pretty extensive vintage factory sealed game collection. And the way I describe it, I think what we're seeing right now happen, because games have just fucking exploded. And I'm talking factory sealed games, not so much loose games, but factory sealed games. And I compare it to the comic book market, you know, the golden age of comics, where we see comics go to insane kind of valuations, I think is what we're seeing right now re-happen with games. So I had a fascination with this shit just early on. But yeah, man, I got super into it. I got a crazy NES and 64 Super NES collection, but I'm getting very into iconic collectibles. Mm-hmm. One of the grails I just got is a factory sealed first generation iPhone.
That's insane.
I had to pull some strings to make it happen, but like it's, you know, this is so much shit to our roots and where we come from, and I think I'm a very nostalgic person and very emotional to where I come from, and I appreciate again, just time just fascinates me, and it's a little difficult to explain in words, but I'm getting very into iconic shit. So I got the iPhone, I'm looking for an iPod, you know, first generation factory sealed, World War II memorabilia, a lot of stuff like that. But yeah, I've grown a pretty extensive collection over time of it.
Wow, that's crazy. Do you have like unopened sealed NES games?
Oh yeah, dude. I got a lot, man. I think I 800 factory sealed games at the moment.
It's crazy to me as a kid who opened everything to know that there's people out there that bought things that didn't open them.
Yeah.
That's crazy to think about that exists. You
know, a lot of what it is stores that it's like overstocked that never got sold, because shit will, like, you know, you take something right now that's really popular. Let's say even a PS4 game, right? Because PS5 just came out. So now we have this sort of surplus of PS4 inventory. And where does it go? You know, it gets liquidated to third-party marketplaces. It goes to different places. So that's kind of how this stuff ends up still factory sealed and unopened. In some cases, it's people that buy and don't open it. In a lot of cases, it's just just overstock that ends up being stored somewhere or just never really getting sold and eventually gets to collector's hands.
What was the one,
but
what was the first one you got that you were just like holding in your hands? Like, oh, did you get like
GoldenEye?
Gold? Oh yeah.
GoldenEye.
64 GoldenEye, bro.
Yeah,
that's
man,
a treasure.
GoldenEye.
There's something,
GoldenEye.
There's something about those old games and like what they came in. Like I was a Nintendo kid. I didn't have a lot of friends, but my dad would buy Nintendo games, and to hold either Mario 2 or 3 in the box is just like special. And to open it up, to go through like the little, they all came with the little catalogs, you know, of like all the, these are all the characters, these are all the bad guys, all these like hand-drawn charts. It's an art, man. It's like, yeah, it's not only my own memories attached, but they themselves are like, things don't have that kind of detail anymore, you know, that kind of love put into them. So there, yeah, there's something special going to like a, there's this place called Frank and Sons in Southern California, and it's all just booths of people selling collectibles, all nerdy stuff. And I just walked through there just like in a daze, man.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I really dig it. I love the 80s art, the 90s art, you know, just the whole vibe. It's so nostalgic, and it's such an amazing piece of history. I think if anything, you know, I got a lot of this shit. It's just, it feels like a museum to me. I just want to preserve it. I have a lot of appreciation for, I mean, it's our childhood, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, we're getting older, and at some point there won't even be anyone left to remember. You know what I mean? Like,
it's
I don't know, man, it's a beautiful piece of history and a beautiful piece of where we came from. And I think that's really what sparked my sort of collection, the kind of collection mentality of it. Yeah.
Do you think one day if you have a little bambino, you're going to let him open it and play some games? Do you dare?
I think I'd probably just buy and open one.
But, you're a real collector, you know, bro.
Yeah. But you know, man, there's another side of me. I think at some point I'm going to snap and just sell it all because it's so much, maybe I'll keep some of like the shit that's really important to me, but at the same time, it's just like, I don't need all this stuff. And sometimes it's a little suffocating being around so much materialism. Like it's a really cool collection. I really vibe with it. I really love it. It's more about the journey for me of collecting and trying to track down my childhood kind of iconic stuff that's still kind of mint factory sealed. But at the same time, I don't really want to define myself by it. And I think at some point I'm probably going to snap and sell it all and like just, you know, become a monk or something. it's just too much stuff. You know, it's a great journey, but I don't think it's really meant to be held onto forever. Yeah.
That's what's up. All right. Before we jump into the lightning round, I just want to plug you and plug your company. So if people want to find you, where should they go?
Yeah. So brightdaycompany.com is our website. You can do our Instagram, Bright Day Company. We have a huge presence on Amazon as well.
Cool, man. All right. So this is the lightning round now. I'm just going to ask you a couple just random questions and feel free to answer them any way you want. All right. The first question. So aliens come down to Earth and they say, Peter, we're going to blow this whole world up unless you take us to the coolest place you've ever been. Where do you take them?
Oh, man. I'd say, try to stay probably inside the Coliseum at like 2 a.m. Yeah.
Do you show them like Gladiator first to give them a little context and then you bring them in?
Oh, man. I don't know. It's so hard to even recollect the coolest place, but I think maybe because we were just talking about it, that was such a crazy memory. But, no, I don't know. I think I'd give him a glass of whiskey and give him a joint. And, what's that?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the light in there at night, like the way it shines in, it's the most majestic. It's just a very majestic thing in there at night, the way the light comes in through all the circular holes going around it. So it's kind of, I think that's kind of one of the things that made it so, so memorable.
Wow, man. I need to go to Italy, bro. That sounds beautiful. I've been watching these old videos of like, they're not that old, but they're just like street performers. And there's this one dude and he's playing Pink Floyd Time in Rome in front of the Colosseum. And it just like, it blows my mind. to see the, like, the old and the new. But anyway, so next question. If you could spend an hour with anyone, dead or alive, who would you spend an hour with?
Thank you, either Bruce Lee or the Dalai Lama.
Why?
I think, man, Bruce Lee, I think, is just the true master of his craft. But Dalai Lama, just, you know, I think probably one of the most humblest human beings on the planet. I would, just to be around that, that presence, would be very humbling, you know, a humbling experience. I'd love to hear what he would have to say, you know.
Have you gone to Dharamsala in India?
No, I haven't. I haven't made it out there yet.
Yeah, I really want to go. The closest I got to him was he spoke like over 10 years ago. And I paid like $200 because I had to see him. And I sat right next to, what's her name? She was some famous chick from the 90s. She was some singer, maybe Sheryl Crow. I don't remember. But it was just, he's been a big inspiration to me my whole life too. So I'm a big Dalai Lama fan. And one day I want to go to Dharamsala where the Tibetans are in India and like, you know, sit closer to him, like in his presence and hear him speak. But that's a good answer. All right, the last question here of the lightning round. The aliens come back and they're like, Pete, we're going to blow this bitch up right now unless you give us the best calendar at Bright Day Calendars. Which one do you give them?
Oh, man, Lumberjacks.
Yo, Lumberjacks. Yeah. There's not like a secret Pete in the snow in the short shorts Wim Hof calendar that you could kick them from out back?
Actually, I take that back, man. I would give them our rescue cats or rescue dogs calendar. And to touch on that, man, we have a really beautiful relationship with some nonprofits. And I think it's our best product. And the mindset behind it is we have everywhere you go, man, whether it's a dollar store, Barnes & Noble, anywhere you go, you're going to see cat calendars, dog calendars, and horse calendars. And it's like, yo, what can we do to... How can we make this better? So we partnered with some local nonprofits. These aren't major nonprofits that have private jets and all that bullshit that nonprofits do. These are local nonprofits that legitimately, you know, the money goes to help high euthanized shelters and help relocate animals in needs of homes. And we have a beautiful line. It's a rescue line. The line's called Calendars for a Cause, but then we have within that a rescue line. Calendars for Cause covers humanitarian, environmental, and animal sanctuaries. But my favorite is with Pet Connect Rescue. It's a rescue cats, rescue dogs. And our gross revenue, 15%, goes to these nonprofits. Yeah, man. I mean, like in the fourth quarter, we were able to donate $40,000 to Pet Connect Rescue.
Wow.
Which, you know, gave us purpose behind going to work.
So
I'm really stoked on it because it's a reason behind, like, what's the fucking point in going to work? You know what I mean? But if you can actually do good in the world, who says you can't profit and do good? You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm saying. You can do both. And if every fucking business out there had that mindset and was like, how can we do both? We would have a different world, man. And I think this is where we need to bring the future of business. And the way we do that is by example. We can fucking talk about this shit all day long, but the way we get there is by people fucking doing, like, you know, making these decisions. And I hope Bright Day Company grows. And I hope if anything, we become an exemplary business model that's like, hey, you can take care of yourself, you can take care of your staff, and you can take care of, to an extent, you know, the world or whatever you're trying to touch and do good business. You know, who the fuck says you can't? It's just fucking, you know what I mean? And it's just like, we should challenge these old ideas we have about capitalism and kind of bring a new wave in. But no, dude, if I was to give the aliens one calendar, it'd be fucking rescue cats, man.
Dude,
let's get some cute cats and let's save some at the same time.
Man. Hey, good answer, bro. Thank you so much for your time, Peter. Like, I fucking appreciate you. I know we don't know each other that well, but just sitting here with you has been an absolute pleasure, man. And I appreciate you sharing everything. And I really hope people do, you know, check you guys out and help contribute. And man, yeah, thank you, dude.
Oh, absolutely, man. Thank you. You know, very much. It's absolutely humble to be here again. It feels very foreign, you know, for me to talk about myself. It's not you know, what do I have to say? I'm just a fucking dude. You know what I mean? But yeah, extremely humbled to be here. And yeah, thank you, man. Excellent discussion. You should definitely catch a joint after some time.
Let's do it.
Maybe I'll fly to LA, pay you a visit.
All right, everyone. I'll catch you later. Peace and love. Bye.
All right, man.